Then he's like just floored. And we have such a cool moment. And then he says, wait, tell me, who's your dad again? I said, his name was Buddy Reyes. And he just stops. And he's like, that was one of my heroes. He said, your dad was so good to me. We worked on film project together and he mentored me and he helped me. And now I'm literally in tears. And he says, let's call your dad. Let's surprise him and zoom him in. And then I have to say, you know, Billy, we just lost Pops. You know, that warrior finally got laid to rest. And he's with Mama now on the Big Island in Hawaii.
I lay there in the middle of the cage. This is the greatest thing I've ever done in my life.
I would bet that it's testosterone levels.
Wait a minute.
Home defense system right there.
It's a feral male. He's a strong.
And the whole idea of adaptive alphas I love because there's this, like you said, sense that alphas like warriors, it's all about the domination side, right? And it's about, you know, the strength to be able to control others, which is part of that, but it's also the servant side, the caring side, which including in law enforcement, we teach our guys to be servant leaders. I told Josh before, our motto in training is, you know, it's practice kindness, prepare for violence, right? Because you have to be able to,
I like that,
you know, be ready, but you need to be respectful. You need to be that. That is who we are. That's what we're about. It goes back to Bushido code and my Japanese side or Hawaiian, you know, Kamehameha warrior side. It's that. And so I'm so glad that you talk about that because I think people view fighters, especially, as like, oh, they're just, you know, knucklehead, knuckle dragon, you know. Door kicking, and it's not about that.
Barbarian, now we fighting to set a stage for the difference we want to make.
Yeah, we definitely want to deep dive your warriorship background for sure.
Oh man, yeah.
What's up, everybody? This is Adaptive Alphas Podcast. Got me, myself, and I, and Josh over here. And today we got a super cool guest. We got the AG, Sean Reyes, showing up to chat with us today. Bro, what's up, brother? How are you?
Oh, man, I'm good. I don't know about super cool, but I am the AG, so at least that part's accurate.
Right. And how are you, Josh?
I'm doing good, man. Yeah? And Wolfpack, today you got a this episode is going to be fuego. I can already tell. It's going to be fire because I did a lot of due diligence on Sean over the weekend, and my Sunday was spent, and it was not time wasted. So
instead of Xanax, when you needed to get to sleep, you started listening.
Instead of my CBD oil,
Well, when you get into when somebody is at the level of an AG, right? That takes a lot and a lifetime, right? It's like it's not a championship, but it is a championship. It's a high level, and so as you research, you got to kind of find years of things and lots of stuff, right? It's like if you Google Josh Berkman. You can go through a few pages of things, right? What did you find on this guy?
Man, a lot. I mean, you can look at his professional background in business, and he ran a fund. And my question to you is, what was the AUM?
I don't know what AUM is.
Assets under management.
Okay.
We were a smaller
fund.
We're
going right into it, huh?
we had, and it's interesting because Accelerate Ventures, we had some different approaches to venture. We thought a lot of venture was maybe a little exploitative of those coming up. And so instead of just investing money, we layered in a lot of our teams. So our developers and engineers to help build the company. And what we would do is give them a promise. If we can get you to certain X, say 10X of where you're at, or we can get you to this and accelerate you, if we hit that mark, then you're going to be in a great position and we'll take a percentage. And so we'll take the equity then. But if we don't hit that, if we can't live up to what our partnership, then you can keep all of what we're giving you and we'll walk away. So it's an interesting value proposition for them. We didn't have billions under management and we were really selective. But for example, one of the things that we did that was pretty innovative to help small businesses was we set up a fund and we may have had 10 million in that fund for litigation for small businesses that had developed intellectual property, so patents that really were essential to that business. So imagine if Josh wanted to create a business around both training young kids and he developed a new system and spent the money and all that. And then a big company layered in and said, hey, we love what you're doing. So we're just going to steal your stuff. And we know you don't have the wherewithal to come after us, the legal fees. And I mean, we'll crush you if you try. What is he going to do? He has no choice. So we would jump in just like, you know, he has for many people to defend them and figuratively just punch them in the nose and say, we're going to take you under our wing, and we'll flex back. And just like a lot of bullies, once you hit them back, then they're like, hey, you know what? Now we realize there's a fight here. Let's just license that. And so what we kind of felt like Robin Hood, like we came in to help, and we would ask for a little bit in return, in exchange, but what was fair to them. And taking that approach and always leaving some so that we never took too much, we developed a lot of loyalty and people wanted to continue to do business with us. But that became kind of a model for, businesses. They were clamoring to come and say, could you help represent us? Because there's so much of that. You know, bullies don't exist just outright on the school ground or on the mat. There are a lot of them in business, and they take advantage, leverage their resources. And so just like you, Josh, and your dad, you know, small business owner, my dad came to this country, tried to build a better life, and so often was on the wrong end of these bullies that would come in and say, we have more lawyers, we have better lawyers, we'll just drive you into the ground. It was one of the things that sort of inspired me to look to a career in law, to try to level the playing field, give the smaller guy a chance to fight back.
Yeah, I thought that was really inspiring. You said the impetus of becoming a lawyer was seeing your dad dealing with all of the people he was in Hollywood, right?
He was in Hollywood, yeah.
Producer, right?
He was a producer and director, and he was also in the art world, but a lot of discrimination.
Mm-hmm. Just because of, and you said, because of his last name.
His last name, you know, it was Reyes, and so a lot of connotations came with that. He wasn't from the U.S., and it was easy to marginalize him. He's the hardest working guy, and he brought value and great product, but it was tough back then, especially in the film industry. There were no indies running. There were no Tarantino and Coen brothers. That you were with a studio or you weren't working. And so that inspired me a lot too, right? You see that enough. You see your parents, nothing worse than watching your parents, you know, struggle, and you want to help chip in and also to protect them.
Yeah, so true. And so that's just a little taste of his professional background. Lawyer, graduated summa cum laude from BYU, undergrad at Berkeley. And then he was on the council for some of the up-and-coming tech companies for last, 15 years before then?
Yeah, I worked with a lot of the tech companies representing them and then investing. And I would have still been doing that with our fund. It was amazing to be able to build and help people realize their dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of happened into the public service side, but have found that pretty fulfilling also.
And climbed the ranks to AG. And if that's not inspiring enough, I guess the question that I have is, how do you have enough time to do all these things?
I don't know.
We're not even talking about the service.
We were just talking about
this
2 hours of sleep last night. Josh and I were both, you know, helping each other up the stairs.
After you.
Because he doesn't sleep either. You know what?
I got a 4-week-old that's like, Dad, wake up. I'm awake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's beautiful, man. What a lucky baby.
So too, let's go back a little bit because when we had our conversation on the phone, I found out a lot obviously you have to have quite the repertoire to be able to get into this place of AG, but also just being a human and being a kid, you know, there were sports, you had more information on martial arts than maybe even I had, you know, so there's definitely a love for martial arts and for UFC, which we're going to talk about UFC coming to Utah. But what about those, Josh mentioned a little bit of bullying, you've mentioned some martial arts in your life. You know, what was the, you know, younger years, the martial arts and the sports that kind of given you this personality?
I kind of have warrior ancestry from all sides, you know?
And you say Bushido, the way of the warrior. Yeah. You know, you definitely have that.
Yeah,
you
from mama's side, she's Japanese, Hawaiian. We have Chinese blood too. But so she's a Maeda. And that Maeda clan goes back to those times of the shogun in that area.
Yeah.
They built Kanazawa Castle in Ishikawa Prefecture, in Ishikawa Ken. I mean, they were great warriors. But then when it was time to put down the sword, then they became real patrons of the arts and culture and kind of living, exemplifying that Bushido code is that you only fight when you have to protect others or yourself. As I mentioned to you, in our law enforcement teams, we do extensive training to try to de-escalate violence and try to only use, force when we have to, especially deadly force. And so we kind of have a motto, practice kindness, train for violence, right? You need to be prepared. And that preparation often will help deter violence But always it's respect and kindness, and you have to respect every person as a fellow human being. And you start with that, and you're not just a warrior, you're a servant warrior, you're a servant leader. You're an adaptive alpha. I love that title. You're not just about the domination and the strength and the power. That has a purpose, and that's to protect and to nurture and to make sure that it signals to others that you're strong, but that strength is never used to abuse others or to take advantage out of pride or anything else, those other sort of ignoble impulses. It's to show that, you know, again, don't mess with us, like you said, because we'll bite back, we'll fight back. But that side of the Japanese heritage was melded on my mom's side with the native Hawaiian. She is a descendant of Kamehameha Mo'i, the chief that helped unite the Hawaiian Islands. In fact, he was born in Kohala on the Big Island of Hawaii. Our family never left. My mom was born in North Kohala, and I would go back almost every summer of my growing up years and learn and work. And you know, it's farming land and ranching land, and it's beautiful. But that spirit of fighting, you know, my grandpa was a notorious fighter on the Big Island, kind of like your grandpa. I wish we could get those two guys together, And my great-grandpa running moonshine over there. But those concepts are important, and there's a lot of warrior tradition, you know, this that I wear that represents kind of, some would say the yin and the yang, or the ocean and the land and different elements, but those parts that bring balance, your chi and your energy. And I learned a lot of that from my dad's side too. So he was a martial artist, and he grew up in that tradition, more Kali and Eskrima, and trained with Danny Nisanto and many of the greats there when he came to the U.S. and certainly when he was still in his homeland of the Philippines. But his uncle was a great warrior. His grandfather during the Japanese occupation of the Philippines during World War II, and I know your grandfather served with a distinguished career there. He learned a lot from that. His uncle then became president of the Philippines, President Magsaysay, a great president. Great not only because he was strong and is renowned for having crushed the communist insurgency, but he didn't crush them through military might. He listened to them. He had compassion, and he realized what they needed most was some land and farming areas, and he dedicated a lot. So he actually did undermine, because once their bellies were full and once they had no reason to challenge capitalism, they said, hey, this guy's great for us. He actually cares about us. And so he was a beloved leader in the Philippines, very strong warrior, but cared mostly about the people. And I don't have time today to tell you, but I'll give you just a thumbnail sketch of this. There were 17 assassination attempts against him that were recorded, probably more. But the one I talk about in TED Talks and other opportunities, this one assassin came and trained for 2 years, was lined up to kill him, and couldn't do it finally because he had said, I've never felt so much love emanating from a person, much less the president, who was on his knees in the mud in front of Malacañang Palace talking to little kids and crying because they were hungry. So he didn't kill him. He was supposed to. He could have shot him. Instead, turned himself in and said, you know, I know I'm going to get executed. Magsaysay turns around and says, hey, you could have killed me. You didn't. Come join me. And he becomes a dedicated bodyguard for our family and outlives the president, protects our family. And so I think that's emblematic of what you're talking about with adaptive alphas and stuff like that, right? It's somebody who's strong and powerful and can protect, but who also cares deeply. And there'll always be critics, and there'll always be people who, you know, don't buy no matter what you say. But if it's really your actions and what you dedicate your time to that show, and he was about helping the Filipino people. So my dad had that kind of example growing up. His father had served with his uncle, and they were all military heroes and warriors, but it was about taking care of other people. My dad got run out of his country during the Marcos regime. That's raw power used the wrong way. That's alpha, maybe, without the adaptive part, with the
Genghis Khan alpha. Yeah,
and look, it's effective. And the world has been, heavily influenced by those who would dominate just with power. But that was a dictator that ran my father away. So he came desperately here. His aunt put him on a plane. They didn't know him. He literally just came to L.A. knowing nobody. in the late 60s, homeless, but just scrapped and scraped, and he was a fighter. And so a few years later, after he met and married my mom, he had established his citizenship, I came along. I grew up literally going to, I don't remember exactly because I was 1 year old, 2 years old, but just like your baby.
Stories being told them.
The stories, and Bruce Lee was there. Danny Nassanta was there.
Was that these, at the same time?
Same time, yeah. This is 1971, 1972.
So if you guys don't know, Danny Nassanta was kind of like the lineage of Bruce Lee and Jeet Kune Do, so, which is also my lineage from a guy named Dan Barry. And Jeet Kune Do was the art of fighting, but it wasn't just in one structure. It was you take what works for you and you leave what doesn't work for you.
Yeah.
And it didn't have to be boxing. It didn't have to be wrestling.
No, you that's know? Exactly so right, Josh.
When he, you know, you say that your father trained with him and stuff, again, that's like, that's everything that I am as a martial artist is I wasn't a boxer, you know, I wasn't a wrestler. I wanted to use everything that I could possibly learn to be the best fighter I could possibly be to help myself live and survive in a situation, you know? And so I think that when you say Danny Nassanta, and you know, I want to make sure that people know that this is the lineage of Bruce Lee. And not only that, but I also have taken my martial arts into politics, into religion, where I don't let it separate me from someone else. I take what works, I find common ground, and I use that common ground to build my relationships, not the differences of what we have and judge you on those differences.
That's why you'd be future governor of Utah. But you're absolutely right about Sifu Dan, about Sensei Dan. In fact, I mean, Bruce Lee is iconic, but for those who know, who are part of martial arts, I mean, Danny Nassanta, that name, there's none bigger. JKD, Jeet Kune Do was the original MMA. It was
absolutely
taking, like you said, the best of all of it. And that, there's a level of humility because Bruce was Wing Chun background and trained and had certain traditions, but realized, you know what? I can learn from anybody, right? There's right. Every culture has its truths. Every culture has its beauty and every style. Some are a little more martial, some are a little art, some are a good blend.
Right. Well, and now too, where so many have such harsh stances and those harsh stances create harsh emotions and harsh kickback, you know, that it's like better to find a little bit of common ground, know, and that's very much was what Bruce Lee and Dan were teaching is like, you know, take what works, leave what doesn't, become the best version of yourself and don't worry about everybody else.
So imagine as a baby, you know, and as a little one going to their dojo, and watching Dad train with sticks with Sensei Dan. So Dan taught Bruce a lot of the, you know, nunchaku. He taught him Kali and Eskrima. He taught him stick fighting, and Bruce taught him all that he knew. And together they fused this incredible, and so many, you know, generations of fighters have branched out and stemmed out from that. And I he's one of my heroes. And there's that little personal connection, but later on, if I get a chance, I'll tell you, there's still a story about that, you know, those who are rooted in their one style. And so I growing up, I loved being around it, but I didn't train largely because when you're trying to fit in as a young Asian kid and you already have a bowl haircut that, you know, lives up to every stereotype and you bring food that smells to, you know, if you listen to Joe Coy, the awesome comedian on Netflix, he talks about some of those experiences, you know, and the other kids are like, oh my gosh, that's nasty. Mm-hmm. And you have all these stereotypes. The last thing you want to do is be like a martial arts guy, right? It's the karate guy.
Right,
you know,
the stereotype.
The stereotypes. So I really tried to, it wasn't that I shunned it. I was like, Dad, I want to play ball. I want to play basketball, football, and all these other things. And I spent a lot more time doing that. He did let me box, and I boxed until I was about 12, maybe 13. But he was worried about head trauma. And he, you know, he was a little bit prescient about, man, all those hits. I worry. I was a pretty good boxer, had a little bit of that in my arsenal. And again, I would train with pops, but I would not say I was a martial artist. I pay such great respect to those of you who dedicate such, you know, time and it's a craft and it's who you are. And I almost feel disrespectful saying I was a martial artist. It really, really wasn't until, and I'll step back a little to the bullying, but it wasn't until I got to BYU and, you know, I got cut from the team that I was supposed to be playing on, and I had a little extra time, I met up with this little guy, and I thought, man, this guy's a martial artist. His name is Pedro Sauer.
Pedro
was a kind of adopted brother of the Gracies, and he had brought this guy named Hickson Gracie, who I was like watching videos of fighting guys on the beaches from Brazil, and I'm like, this guy's intense. And if I could learn from him, this would be great. So Pedro graciously, I think he almost charged us nothing because we were poor students. We were training even before the Bowen Levitt facility in Linden. We were in the world's gym on a floor about as hard as here in the studio. I mean, you got thrown down there, man. It was like you woke you up, blood everywhere.
And if you don't know Pedro, I mean, you probably do, but Pedro Sauer, I'd say every single jiu-jitsu dojo in Utah has Pedro Sauer affiliates, either teaching or in their club. I mean, he definitely is a big part of jiu-jitsu spreading not only across the world, but Utah.
Definitely too. One of the pioneers. Yeah, might have been the sure. first he, really serious one with ties back to, you know, Brazil. You had guys like Walt Bayless and many other greats who were out here that had a lot of that in their repertoire. But Pedro was full, just BJJ, and it was all like, you know, it was kind of the Gracie brand. And so it was awesome. And he had incredible fighters, you know, that I went in and I was just in awe. And I don't even, at the time, I didn't realize, looking back, I'm like, what was I doing with Mark Schultz, rolling with Mark Schultz, you know, perhaps the greatest fighter that's ever graced, you know, the state of Utah, both in his Greco-Roman Olympic career and you add jits and other things. I was like, oh my gosh. But he was just rolling with us at the time, and Lonnie and Big Todd and all these guys that were just such great friends and fighters, and I loved it. Never actually graduated above white belt. I was probably good enough to be a blue belt. Pedro was getting me ready to do the equivalent of testing, and then I left to go to law school, and so I was supposed to come back. I ended up playing volleyball for Berkeley, and so got too tied up in practices and never
martial
tested.
Arts a jealous girlfriend.
Yeah, well, man, it's all you got to like be all in, man. No, you know. But this is where I get to the story. So I get to Berkeley, and other guys have heard of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. They've watched Gracie videos. None of them have actually ever trained. They've never seen a Gracie. They've never touched one. And so I'm the closest thing. So they're like, hey, can you train us? And I'm like, yeah, sure. You know, I don't charge them. It's the way that we just do it. But literally, like, they're showing me these old VHS. It was that time. It was awesome. Right. So I get there and I go to try to train in the facility that is open to all of the students there. We all pay tuition. It's supposed to be an open gym. And the gentleman that runs the training area, the mats and everything, is like a fourth dan, fifth dan, like very old Korean Taekwondo master. And so I show him the great respect that he deserves and ask him if we can train. And he says, no. Well, he asked me, well, what style is this? And I said, you know, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. He said, oh, no, that's not a martial art, you know? And and I said, no, I think it is. He goes, no, there's, you know, there's no art to that. There's no, they don't respect. And so short story, he said, no. And so I was like, you know what? Pedro used to have us go around not to embarrass anybody and not to disrespect any other style, but to just show that Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu deserved to at least be acknowledged. We would literally just go from dojo to dojo and challenge. He would challenge matches, he would have us challenge. And we always won because back then stand-up guys had no concept. And once you got them down, I mean, maybe there was a little vulnerability for a split second while you were shooting in, but once they're on the ground, it was over.
Fish out of water.
Yeah, you know it. You know, so back in those days, first of all, I felt like a superhero. I had some mutant power because nobody else had this. Later, once guys like Berkman, like super studs, actually got those skills, then the real fighters like Josh rose to the top. And guys like me, I was getting my head bashed in tournaments and stuff. But at the time, I'm up at Berkeley.
You were getting degrees and I was busy fighting.
No, you're younger than me, man. You were doing what you needed to be doing at the time. But so this guy, I threw out a challenge and said, sir, look, with all due respect, I mean, we should be able to train here, but you know what? Give us a chance and let me fight. You pick a couple of your black belts and I'm a white belt. Like, you know, so he let me pick some guys and in short order, I dispatched all of them. Some other day I'll tell you how, you know, I had some good strategies, but it was pretty evident that his guys were outmatched. And to his credit, he said, you know what, you can train and maybe we can learn some things from you. And that's up there, we started to, you know, everybody wanted to come in and learn this, and we'd learn stuff from them. But it goes back to your point that if you have a modicum of humility, you can really learn and better yourselves and impart your truth and knowledge, and it really helps the entire ecosystem, right? I think the MMA movement really helped elevate martial arts, which used to be just, you know, karate or kung fu and different things. Bruce started that, but then the MMA, what UFC and other promotions have become, have, I think, really raised the level and brought a wider audience and helped mainstream it. I mean, you know, MMA is probably more popular than boxing amongst young people.
Absolutely.
Today.
What would you say are three, if you could extract just three really potent lessons that you learned from your experience in MMA that you used in politics or in the business, in your professional life?
I want to answer that, Josh. Let me go back because I promised, okay, and you guys brought it up several times, and it layers into how I answer that question. Going back in the time when I was about, I think it was like 13, I was in junior high school. And again, I hadn't been practicing a lot with my dad. We moved from the tougher part of LA in Westchester, Inglewood, right there on the, right by Randy's Donuts downtown by the airport. It was a tougher place. We moved out to the San Fernando Valley. I was not popular. I was a nice kid, but I was playing Dungeons and Dragons, playing video games, again, bull haircut, and all of the country club kids where I went to junior high were beating up all of my friends, and I would jump in every time. And so hence I got beat up a lot too. Junior high is hard enough. I don't know anybody who actually loved junior high school. If they did, they were probably kind of weird or rich. I don't know. It seemed like the only kids that really dug middle school. But I hated that. And I wouldn't say I was anything close to suicidal. But, man, there were plenty of days where I was like, I wish I wasn't here. Anywhere else I could go than to get, you know, have to jump in with all these guys and get thumped by all these kids. And so around that time, my dad had been working films, and he was working with a young actor named William Zabka, Billy Zabka. He had just played Johnny Lawrence in a film that went supernova called Karate Kid. And of course, we had all seen it. And I'm over at Johnny Lawrence's house, at Billy's house, and he's giving me a pep talk and says, you know what?
That's awesome.
He says, you know, he's about 4 or 5 years older. So he's graduated from high school, but we're all in the same neighborhood. And he said, you know what? You're a really good kid. Don't let these guys get you down. And the next time you're getting bullied, you tell them that Johnny Lawrence is your bodyguard, that Billy Zabka will come and, you know, I'll kick their butts if they mess with you. I'm like, oh my God, this is so cool. So, you know, like clockwork, next time I was there, I'm, you know, we're throwing down in the, you know, in the hallway. And by the way, this is like, I'm there with a lot of other Asian kids who are getting thumped, and they're so obedient that the bell rings. I'm standing there taking their lumps for them, and they all rush away to get to class because they don't want to be late. So they leave me there, you know, just one on six. And just so then I get hauled into the principal's office. My mom's a principal. It's really bad. My mom's an Asian tiger mom. She grounded me one time because I got an A- in AP calculus in ninth grade. So this is the kind of mom that I've got, right? I had to have a 4.0 or I was grounded all summer. It's crazy. But going back to Billy, I'm getting thumped, and I'm like, hey, stop hitting me. You know what? Billy Zabka is he's my bodyguard. And all of a sudden they're like, hey, you know him? And I'm like, yeah, like he's my friend. They're like, hey, could you get us an autograph? And I'm like, oh yeah, I could probably get you a headshot with an autograph. They're like, oh dude, that's awesome. So all of a sudden, I didn't become popular, but they left me alone. I don't think it was what Billy had intended. You know, he thought they were gonna run away. They all just wanted to meet him. So he came, and after that, like, so fast forward, because I think it's a cool story, and it's why we created Safe UT. Because of the bullying and online bullying, which is even worse now. But a great friend, a guy named Dan Farr, created Salt Lake Comic Con. It's now been rebranded Fan X here in Utah.
I didn't know that. So, when did that get rebranded?
Well, there was a lawsuit. And
oh, gotcha, stuff. Gotcha.
This other Comic Con down in Southern California with the initials of SD got a little jealous because we were catching up and even starting to lap them. So, you know, again, back to the courts we go, and lawyers and all that. But We've rebranded FanX, and Dan's a partner, and we work together on a lot of stuff. I love to cosplay, dress up as, you know, Dark Lords of the Sith, and go do that. I've played a role down at Evermore with another friend where I dress up as the Black Knight of Evermore and play.
You never lost the Dungeons and Dragons feel, right?
Bow down, mortals, to the Black Knight of Evermore, and we explore all that, you know. Anyway, it's great,
right?
But. Yeah, we have some really good fun over there. But we had a FanX where the Cobra Kai cast was coming recently. This was last year. And so I say, hey, Dan, let me go pick up Billy Zabka at the airport, you know? And Dan's like, hey, yeah, no problem. We'll do that. And I said, I'll bring him and drive him in. I have my law enforcement shirt. And so he'll just think it's, an escort, security escort. So it worked great. I pick him up, and Marty Cove, who plays Sensei Kreese, picked them up right off the airplane. They're like, wow, this is the coolest thing ever. We've been to thousands of Comic Cons. No one's ever sent a police escort to bring us back. And so we're shooting the breeze a little bit. And he goes, you're like the most popular law enforcement officer I've been around, because we're in the airport and people are like, hey, can I take a selfie? And like, hey, Sean, come here. I'm like, oh, they're just very pro law enforcement here in the state. He's like, this is really cool. And so we get to this point where I finally am like, look, sir, I gotta confess, you know, I know that you're from, you know, California. And he's like, oh yeah. He said, where are you from? California? I said, yeah, I am too. He said, where? I said, Southern California. I went to high school in San Fernando Valley. He's like, get back. I'm from right there. He doesn't recognize. He doesn't know. And I said, yeah no, I know. I know where your house is. I tell him his address, his sister's name, his cat's name, and where his bedroom was. He's and like, he's now what? Freaking out. And he's like, oh my gosh, are you one of those like stalker crazy dudes? Like, you can have my money, whatever. You know, I'm like, no. Let me tell you the story. And I tell him the story of how in a critical time in my, you know, adolescence, he literally stepped in and was like a larger than life hero for me. Now, I mean, he's got like a tear. And he's like, that's incredible. He's like, I helped a police officer, you know,
he doesn't know you're the AG yet.
He doesn't. No. I think it was Marty Kreese. He's like, I don't think he's a police officer, Billy. He's like, everybody keeps calling him general. He's like, are you a general? I'm like, no, I'm not a real general. I'm like an attorney with a general, attorney general. And then he's like just floored. And we have such a cool moment. And then he says, wait, tell me, who's your dad again? I said, his name was Buddy Reyes. And he just stops. And he's like, that was one of my heroes. He said, your dad was so good to me. We worked on film project together, and he mentored me and he helped me. And now I'm literally in tears. And he says, let's call your dad. Let's surprise him and zoom him in. And then I have to say, you know, Billy, we just lost Pops. You know, that warrior finally got laid to rest. And he's with Mama now on the big island in Hawaii. But, you know, it was, so I said, hey, instead, is your dad still around? This guy was also a war hero. His father ran the Tonight Show for 25 years behind the scenes. And he said, yeah, he's still around. So tried to reach out to his dad. Anyway, I just thought it was a cool story, because you never know the influence that you'll have in one kind word, one gesture. And I tell kids whenever I speak at junior highs and high schools, man, you don't have to go overboard and be best friends with anyone. But, man, let the kids, those kids that you all know who they are, that are marginalized, that people make fun of, bring them to your table.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. Help them out. Protect them a little bit. Be that adaptive alpha. Mm. Show people how strong you are by how much you care and how much you can, you know, give of yourself that way. And
that's what you know, that's what we teach at the dojo.
Yeah.
You know, you've said this a couple times, you know, but I'm not teaching kids to be professional fighters. I'm teaching kids to be strong and confident, especially in these moments where they're young and they're insecure. You know, and I've said this multiple times on the podcast that it's not the trained, confident martial artist that's picking on kids. It's the insecure weakling that's constantly trying to prove themselves. And then somebody picks on a kid and somebody's like, oh, if I pick on them, I won't get picked on. You know, and that's constantly what I'm just training kids to take deep breaths, to keep good posture, even in conflict, and then learn to take that outside the dojo. I don't care if these kids ever want to be pro fighters, but I think it's good to have those white belt skills to at least know how to defend yourself so that you can walk around as a confident human being. You know.
Amen to that. And again, I got to take my hat off to you, champ, for what you're doing with kids. You even you probably don't realize the impact that you're having and all of the positivity that you're creating. And I'll tell you this, from being, you know, one of the law enforcement leaders in our state, at least at the state level, right there at the top, you don't realize how many of those that we have to interact with on the dark side,
right,
could have avoided a lot of their bad choices if they had someone like you, just someone to consistent that they could look to and who believed in them and gave them that positive reinforcement. So going back to Josh's question, you know, what three things did martial arts prepare you to do as Attorney General? You hit on one of them. I mean, whether it's making an argument in court, whether it's, you know, negotiating with the other side on behalf of the victims of the state of Utah and fighting for them there, or undercover in an operation on a sting to rescue little girls and boys from the clutches of horrible human traffickers, having that ability to stay calm under any circumstances,
right,
have your wits about you, even if you're in a really bad situation, it's not going to get any better by panicking. And that takes practice.
Absolutely.
But
training.
I remember it from my dad's training and from all right. these things. You may not at the time realize how important that is, but it helps keep you centered. The second thing I learned is that physical training alone is not enough. You have to be a well-balanced individual. You talked about the prayer and the meditation and the
right.
that have helped you in your post-fight career yep. really kind of become more well-rounded and fulfilled. And so there is a spiritual component. I don't mean just religious. I just mean spiritual. There's
Absolutely.
There's an emotional and a psychological development. And all of that is what martial arts really helped bring to me. It was a way of life more than just a skill. And in my job, there are so many different manifestations of emotion when you're dealing with with victims who are children of child pornographers or sex predators and things. It's hard to not, you know, internalize that, but to be your most effective self, you have to still find a way to balance compassion, but not let it throw you off of all the other things that you have to do. You
right.
know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so it sounds like, as I'm hearing you, one of the priorities that you had while you were in office was suicide prevention. Right.
Yeah.
And so it sounds like we found kind of the root value and why you started championing that cause. And that's this app that you guys created, right? Safe Utah. Could you tell our community a little bit about that?
You know, when I came into office, Josh, I was not totally surprised, but I was really taken aback by the statistics that the number one cause of death for youth, I mean, no surprise to you all because you've worked with so many of them, was suicide. And that it was not just number one, but it was more than the next three causes of death combined: accidents, drug overdoses, all these. If you put all of those together, it still wasn't as much as suicide. And so it was at an epidemic level. And I was like, why? And I talked to so many people. So I'm the new AG. And they're like, well, we've got all these studies and we're studying more. And I said, keep studying. That's great. But I want to do something while we're studying that actually is our
outlet or
is an outlet. It's a lifeline. It's something that it's literally something that they can immediately grasp and find some relief or some light in a very, very dark place that they might be in. So it's a crisis mode. So we tried to create a 3-digit number, and I won't get into all the politics of all the people who opposed it and all the different agendas, because that's just what politics too often is like. There's a lot of selfishness in that. All I wanted was a lifeline for kids, and I couldn't get it done in the state of Utah. So we ended up going to Senator Hatch and Congressman Chris Stewart and said, we want to do it at the federal level. But this was 2014, and it took us like 5 years to get the bill passed federally, to get the FCC to finally designate a number. By the way, there is now a number.
Congratulations.
We have... I'm not going to give it out because I don't want everybody to call it yet. It's right. going to take us a few years to build up behind it. Just like 911 mm-hmm. is a crisis number for physical emergencies, this new 3-digit number, I used to say it all the time, and then everybody was calling it and getting disappointed, and I was like, okay, It took a lot of years to build up the infrastructure behind 911 so that when you called, it got referred to the right place. There is, it's federal law now in every state, and Utah's in the process of building up those, that infrastructure, so that if somebody's cutting, if somebody is addicted, if they are ideating suicide, if they are just, not just, but if they're depressed and it's leading to other, you know, self-harm, or they're thinking of harming somebody else, they can call that number and get immediate help and resources. So that was our goal. What we realized is it was going to take us in 14 a long time to get this. So immediately we created the Safe UT app. And I've got to give credit to another fight fan, a guy named Senator Daniel Thatcher. He's a huge fight fan. He'd be here fanboying with Berkman if he could. I told him to stay away. So we didn't get distracted. But he brought this to me and said, the legislature's not really being as supportive as they should be right now. They have since become very supportive. But I said, I'll do it in a nanosecond for my office. Let the AG's office sponsor it. Again, I'm a little naive at the time. I want to, if it's good, we'll just do it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's better not to know all of the rules and the protocols. But we got it out, and immediately it had an impact. Because the secret sauce, Josh, behind it is that the technology isn't earth-shattering. It's a way for a child to get anonymously and privately connected to a world-class therapist who has experience with youth, helping so walk them off the ledge, you know, proverbially, regardless of, but not just a generalist, somebody who has his mental behavioral health expertise. And they're very expensive and they're rare, but we grabbed a lot of them for Utah and funded it, so that's the magic behind it. They're not getting a phone tree. Can you imagine as a child? And I had this experience with a dear friend of mine who lost her daughter. I don't want to lose it here. She called and it was like, well, if you need help, press 1, leave a message. And after her death by suicide, they found out because on her phone she had called this number and only gotten, you know, last call. For us, Safe UT represented a light that could go out, not just for the children themselves, but if their sister was ODing and they needed Narcan, and and right away someone would react and respond. If their brother was being bullied and was going to take his life, or and this is important, said, I want to get even with those bullies, that could go in and law enforcement could be notified. We had, I think this was just, as of 2 years ago, we had hundreds. I don't want to overstate, but it's in the range of about more than 500 validated incidents at schools of either guns, knives, or bombs that had been brought in, but had been prevented through the Safe UT app because one student said, hey, I heard little Johnny, he's been bullied, which is horrible, but he said he was going to go get even. He's bringing his dad's gun. And because of this, a school resource officer was able to meet Johnny at the steps of the school and say, Johnny, look, I know you've had a really hard time and we want to help you with that.
This is real time. Like, this really happened.
Yeah.
Wow.
But this isn't the way to do it. Can I look in your backpack? And there's the weapon that he could have used. I'm not saying that of those 500 plus incidents that they would have all resulted in mass shootings or school shootings, but statistically, if you look at that, this app and all of the people who help run it and all of our volunteers probably have protected Utah from at least one or more school shootings. And so,
which makes everything worth it.
What makes it all worth it? That function alone.
Right.
Would be worth its weight in gold. We've had other states, we've had congressional hearings that have come back and have highlighted Safe UT as the best thing that they've ever seen. Other states try to copy it. But it really was for suicide initially, and suicide is still, but just one of many. Suicide is just one way that people try to take away their pain. Sometimes they drown it out with drugs. Sometimes they cut themselves or hurt themselves in other ways too. Sometimes it's an eating disorder or someone just being mercilessly bullied and cyberbullied and saying, I don't know what else to do and I don't want to talk to my parents. There are lots of predators out there. So many human trafficking cases, we've gotten the first tips from Safe UT.
Wow.
And so this has just been a device. When you empower kids, to be able to be your eyes and ears. It's extremely
they're watching everything.
Great tool. Yeah. And then we have to sift through some things. Of course, there's, you know, kids who try to joke around with it, but the lives that it saves are countless. I mean, it's really hard to measure how many suicides haven't taken place, but it's one of the crowning, you know, achievements that from my time in the AG's office that I'll feel most proud of. That was just the stopgap until we got that three-digit
number
in place. But now they work in combination because this is just a crisis tool. We're saving them in the moment. They still need some help and support long-term. And so, it's just a tool. And unfortunately, we don't do a good job as a country. We haven't with mental behavioral health challenges. There's too much of a stigma that's existed, whether it's addiction or homelessness or all these other manifestations of what really, you know, whether it's Republicans, Democrats, or others, it doesn't matter. We haven't put the resources that we truly need to resolve these issues. We try to mask them or we send them to law enforcement and hope that we can arrest our way out of these things. It certainly is not effective. We need more beds. We need more recovery. We need the kind of stuff that Court McGee, right. You know, our friend is working on, a great fighter, but his, you know,
McGee
his
project, yeah. His nonprofit with substance abuse and stuff, you know,
substance abuse and addiction recovery and those kinds of things. Court's been a great partner because all of these things that we're talking about, whether it's suicide or addiction, to me, all generate from pain that kids are feeling, whether that pain is separation or they're you know, because of things at home or the way that they feel about themselves, which again, Champ, is why I'm so excited about what you're doing. And I'm such a big supporter. And I hope that you do scale it so that every child in the state has the opportunity to get a little bit of what you're serving up over there.
Absolutely. I think, you know, there's a lot of different modalities, but I think martial arts and breath and movement is a really good place to create prevention or even healing with other things, you know, I think. And that's why, you know, I think that, you know, people hold their pain. They hold their pain in their body. And when you get physical exertion, that sometime that emotion and that pain gets released, and then it's easier to go talk to the therapist. Then it's easier to go do certain things. And, you know, I have two little boys. You know, I got my 9-year-old son and my 7-year-old son. You have kids. You have kids. We're all in the world of raising good kids, you know, and good parents and good mothers raise good kids, you know, and Utah, like you said, is, you know, at the front of this, like, Safe Utah thing, the tip of the spear of the three numbers to help save kids, you know. But, you know, sometimes we talk too much Democrat and Republican, too much party, and those divisions create, you know, opinions on things and people. And, for me, you know, like I said, I think sometimes the agenda of what we're doing is the greatest thing. And sometimes you have to tie into other things to get an agenda done. And which brings us to the one of the things that I think is probably one of the most important things that you're doing. And I think that Utah's at the head of a lot of things, you know, but child trafficking is it the biggest business?
Yeah.
In the world, is one of the biggest?
You know, it's hard to get an exact...
Right.
Bead on where it sits because the traffickers don't respond to our Survey Monkey. You know, it's not like
of course.
It's hard to get real-time data.
Right.
According to most experts, it's one or two. It's behind drug dealing as the most lucrative international crime, or it's crept up and surpassed it. Frankly, our office prosecutes both types of cases, and often they're intermingled.
Right.
I frankly think human trafficking has probably surpassed drug dealing, especially if you consider, like I do, human trafficking to be more than just sex trafficking. It's forced labor, it's organ harvesting. So taking, you know, a human being, whether, you know, it's some or all of their organs. So sometimes you can take a kidney and they're still alive, but oftentimes it results in their death. And I don't mean to get too graphic on the show, guys.
It's hard to hear, but once you hear it and once you hear of it and see it, it's hard to turn away from it,